I've got Lucille Paru from Papua New Guinea and Natalie Lowry, who's a Kiwi based in Papua New Guinea, I think. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Thank you.
Hi.
And Lucille, you are a chief in Papua New Guinea, but you have a proper word for that that's not chief.
Yes, we use the title Ovia.
Kiwis Against Seabed Mining just had a meeting last night just to update members and basically the last campaign, which they kind of lost. They're in the Court of Appeal appealing the decision by the decision-making committee of the EPA. So that was basically the gist of their update. But Lucille and Natalie are involved in the same issue in Papua New Guinea. Natalie, you are originally from New Zealand, so what's your connection into Kiwis Against Seabed Mining?
So I grew up here in Aotearoa, South Auckland girl, but spent many weekends and summers in Piha.
Yeah.
And I'm based in Sydney, so I don't live in Papua New Guinea, but I do go there and work there. So about the same time that, I guess, CASM was forming, or, you know, all the seabed mining stuff was happening here,
yeah,
we were forming a campaign around deep sea mining, which is slightly different. It is obviously in deeper water.
Is it the same materials or similar materials?
No, there's three types of deep sea mining. There's the mining of hydrothermal vents, which are the volcanoes in the deep sea.
Yeah.
So they're 1,500 metres or more. Then there's cobalt crusts, which form on seamounts. You see a lot of that around the Cook Islands. And then the third one is manganese nodules. They're a lot deeper. They're up to 6,000 metres. And the main area they're looking at is between Hawaii and the Baja coast in Mexico, and there's an area called the Clarion-Clipperton Zone, which has been carved up by about 26 different countries. But the first one,
yeah,
and the first place to have a green light to operate is the Soil One project in the Bismarck Sea of Papua New Guinea, and it's in a Canadian company called Nautilus. So this hasn't been done anywhere in the world. It's a complete experiment. We don't believe there's the science out there yet to understand what the impacts will be, but we're very certain there'll be impacts at every stage. And we're deeply concerned of the impacts, not just on the marine life, but how that will affect the whole food chain right up to the coastal communities, of which in Papua New Guinea, millions of people rely on the sea.
Mm.
And I guess in the connection here with CASM is that right from the beginning, There were people here like Phil McCabe and Vera, and then there was also people in Namibia also finding more shallow seabed mining. And we all just started talking because it's such a frontier issue and no big NGOs was really looking at it.
Right.
So we created the solidarity over the years of just saying, hey, we're not alone. Even though slightly different forms of seabed mining,
yeah,
we know the impacts are going to have the same sort of devastation.
Okay. And Lucille, I don't think many people in New Zealand know too much about Papua New Guinea except that it's up above Australia on the map. So which part of Papua New Guinea are you from? And I don't even know where the Bismarck Sea is exactly.
Okay, if we look at the map of Papua New Guinea and West Papua, which is the island of Papua, we've been split into two. You have West Papua on the western end, which is controlled by Indonesia.
Yeah.
And you have Papua New Guinea, which is directly north of Australia. Okay, Papua New Guinea has a population of between 8 to 9 million people. And I come from an area that is commonly known as the city of Papua New Guinea, Port Moresby. If I were to correct that, before Captain Moresby came, it was Motukaita.
Right.
And that's where I come from.
Okay, and the Bismarck Sea is?
The Bismarck Sea is in an area which we call the New Guinea Islands, which was the frontal area of World War II. Those are our island areas to the north. A lot of people now know about Manus.
Yeah.
Okay, yes. You have Manus province, which is directly on the north. It's near the equator. And you have Nauru with Guam on the upper end of the equator. So that's how close we are in terms of where Manus is. And then from Manus, you have the Bismarck Archipelago, which is built in between the provinces of Western East Sepik, which is near to where Irinjaya is. Do you know?
Yeah.
Okay, Irinjaya is on the northern part of the island of Papuas. And then you have East and West New Britain, a New Island province, and then Bougainville. So the Bismarck Archipelago fits along that area of the New Guinea Islands as well as the New Guinea region of Papua New Guinea.
Okay, so for people in New Zealand, a lot of us have been to the Pacific and are familiar with people living in a kind of a traditional lifestyle, but with lots of modern trappings as well. Is it similar in Papua New Guinea? Like living off the land or off the sea?
Yes, we still have over 85% of our people still depending on subsistence or rural basis of living, where we still depend on our land and we still depend on our sea very much.
Okay, and I think maybe it's a bit of the political background. Like most parts of the world, Europeans arrived and took control, and this is why your land is split down the middle. There's a line down the middle on the map, which, from what you were saying before, I think is probably quite artificial to the people who've always lived there.
Yes.
Is that a very strong border, or are people crossing it? Or
It is a very strong border. Indonesia is very staunch in its stand to hold our people.
Okay. And?
And the same holds for Papua New Guinea. We were underneath the British and the Australian colonization. It did not do very well for our country. We have a lot of our people that are still underneath this colonized mentality, of which we're fighting to decolonize our people in their way of behavior. If you were to walk into Papua New Guinea, they will treat you as a boss, as somebody, as if you've fallen from heaven.
Me, if I came in, because I'm white.
Because you're white.
Right.
We still have a lot of our people who do that. And we're trying to change that in our societies, because we need to start fighting for our land and our ways. And it's our land. And even though we've had independence, we don't really feel free, because the colonizer has now changed from being a white face to a black face. Where it's now our PNG government, which is now suffering our people, making decisions, taking loans that they shouldn't be taking, and going far beyond where we have now facing land grabbing, and now they're mining our seas. We've got our land being mined. We can see tailings poisoning our rivers, poisoning our land. And when you have people who are still living and depending on the land, it pushes them out to look for land where they can garden. Now, our illiteracy rate is about 64%, so a lot of our people can't read.
Yeah.
And we depend on oral or showing pictures in order to teach them as to what is happening around them. They're basically uninformed. And that leaves them very vulnerable to what the government is doing in terms of proceeding with such things as deep sea mining. Then you have only about 4% of our people formally employed in working. The rest are subsistence farmers. They garden and go and sell that to make money. We don't really have that many entrepreneurs or local businesses that are running. They're all international businesses that have come in and set themselves up. Yes, I may say that our Prime Minister may be doing infrastructure, but it's only stuck around Port Moresby. The rest of Papua New Guinea is still undeveloped, according to the Western society. But the way I view development is, if it damages you, and if you look at developed countries and they still have far worse issues such as homelessness, why would I want to follow that path? Because in my society, you have land, there's no homelessness. Nobody is left to hunger because we have land to garden from. Nobody's left without water because you have a water hole to get water from. Unless there's a drought, then there's other ways to look for water, like rainwater. Or we do have a way of desalinating the ocean.
If you've just come to New Zealand, so I don't know, you're probably not terribly familiar with the history of the indigenous culture in New Zealand and what happened to it through the process of civilization. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, it seems that we are all facing the same thing. Whether it be here or whether it be in Australia or in American Samoa or Hawaii, us, the indigenous people, have been ignored. We've had people just walk in and put in a flag and claim that it's their land simply because they believe that they're serving their queen, but in forgetting that we also have our queens and kings here on our own land.
So before you said that Papua New Guinea has its own independent government, but I have read that the Australian government has quite a strong hold over them. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
About 200 years ago, when the British decided to land on Papua New Guinea looking for Her Majesty's Commonwealth, they set up the British first in the Papuan Territory, and then after World War II, in winning the World War II and removing the Germans and the Japanese, the British then handed it over to Australia, who became our mother country, as most Papua New Guineans like to say. In being our caretaker government, Australia knew much about our land. From Sarong to Milne Bay, they know where exactly our oil and gas are. We do have the third largest oil and gas deposit in the world.
That's something you don't actually hear much about. You hear about Venezuela, and we all know about the Middle East. Yeah.
Yes, but we are eyed by many nations. Hence, you can see why Indonesia holds very strongly onto West Papua. We have gold that runs all over the country, basically.
And so, like a lot of countries in the Pacific, I know some islands were their mother country was New Zealand for a while, and then they technically gained independence. This is what's happened with Papua New Guinea.
Yes, we gained independence, but I don't think we are independent fully because we kept the system. A lot of our constitution is a copy and paste of the Australian, including especially the education system. And the education system between from 1973 to around the late 1980s was with how the colonial master wanted it run, where we learnt specific things and were ignored in not learning the other stuff because we might get too smart for them. And then in handing it over to the PNG government, who was not really mature enough to manage a nation, we've now seen that in 42 years, the result of it were our children are not fit enough to go to university, our own university. So the quality of education, the health system, everything that should be basic within a Westminster system has gone crashing down.
So I think the only issue I'm kind of familiar with is what's happening on Manus Island with the refugees that the Australian government is sending there. Given that that's not Australian territory, I guess that says about the dominant position the Australian government holds over the Papua New Guinea government.
Absolutely.
That they can just make that happen.
Yes. You'll find that Australia sends a lot of AusAid money, but it's not actually utilised in things that are really, really beneficial for the people. I'll give an example. You build a hospital in Central Province. There's a village called Hisiu, and the World Bank decided to sponsor in building of clinics or aid post centres. And AusAid also combined in with to help with the project. They built a nice little square building. There's no furniture in it. There's no medicine in it. There's no health worker in it. But it's an aid post. And they have a huge celebration. Everybody comes and says, yes, the World Bank, yes, Australia has helped with putting up an aid post. 2 years later, it is still an empty building with no aid worker, no medicine, nothing whatsoever, no furniture. And they're still happy. Nobody goes back and checks where has this money gone to. It's gone into ministers' pockets. It's gone into Member of Parliament's pockets. It's gone to people who sit happily and works happily with the government's pockets. It does not benefit the people.
So who was the construction firm that built it? Were they a local firm or were they owned by someone from out of the country?
It's a person who has been working with the PNG government for over 42 years, an Australian company, Curtin Brothers.
Okay, I think that sums up the situation. So, folks, we're talking to Lucille Paru from Papua New Guinea, and we're here to talk about seabed mining. So that's just given some background. We all know about our seabed mining fight here in New Zealand. So what are they trying to mine off the coast of Papua New Guinea?
Well, within PNG, we sit on the Pacific Rim of Fire, so we do have a number of volcanoes that are still very much active.
Okay.
And we have hydrothermal vents, which are underneath our seas. Now, these hydrothermal vents hold many different types of minerals. Nautilus Minerals, who's the Canadian company, I wish they would go back to their own country and mine their own country. But they have chosen to mine ours, and that will affect 6 million people. Now, Nautilus Minerals is after gold, silver, copper, nickel, cobalt.
And how deep is a deep sea vent?
Between 1,500 to 2,000 metres in the sea.
Okay, so a couple of kilometres down.
Yes.
And so it must be, I presume it's a different process to the seabed mining here, where they're going to put a big machine down that digs down like 5 or 6 metres and just processes the whole thing.
I think the only difference is the depth. But okay. Everything else is relatively the same.
Okay.
The machines look the same and they all do the same work. The scary bit is how much of our sea are they going to damage? Our fisheries, our corals, the whole entire ecosystem, how the marine life works and lives as one.
So do we know much about what's down there? In that, I mean, if it's a deep sea vent, I presume there's quite a lot of life around it in actual fact.
There is. And I don't see how people can be so ignorant of that. That there are creatures down there that do also help our existence in life. Now, if you're going to damage something down there which feeds a lot of marine life, our mammals, and if their food is destroyed, where will they go to? They've been living for centuries, moving in certain circles to do breeding, and a lot of where these vents are, you'll find that these mammals, our fish, go around there to breed. Now, the Bismarck Archipelago holds 16% of the tuna in the world.
Wow.
Why would you want to destroy an area of which they go and breed?
Is there a fishing industry in that area?
Yes, there is. And the government is on one side talking about fisheries and how it will promote it, and on the other end, promoting deep sea mining. You cannot sit on the fence.
In New Zealand, it's produced the effect, almost an unusual effect, of seeing the fishing business and environmentalists joining together to fight seabed mining. Has that happened at all?
We are hoping to do that. But you'll find that the same minister that takes care of our fisheries is the very same minister who's taking care of our mining. So he's quite a confused idiot on the top, if I may put it.
But a rich confused idiot, would you say?
Yes, because he's making a lot of money out of it. The problem with our country is the level of corruption.
And it sounds...
Everything that comes out of it always ends up in one member's pocket.
So the other thing about a deep sea vent is it sounds like quite a small part of the ocean floor, like I'm imagining, because I don't know anything, like a small skinny strip somewhere. But the mining is not just going to be on that little bit, is it? Or is it going to be wider?
No, it covers 11 provinces when it comes to exploration sites. That's a massive area.
Right.
The whole of the North Island of New Zealand would fit in there.
Oh, really? That big? Right, okay. Well, that puts me in the picture.
Yeah, just to sort of add, so Sawara 1 is the first project that's been given the operating licence, but Nautilus has tenements right across the Bismarck Sea.
Right.
And it's very clear from our research that Sawara 1 is not economic. And Nautilus has come out this year saying, there won't be just one Sawara, there'll be another Sawara and another Sawara. So the idea is to open up the whole of the Bismarck Sea. And the reason why this issue is so important, not just for the communities that are frontline in PNG, but for all of us, is because over 1.5 million square kilometres of the Pacific Ocean is under exploration leasehold for deep sea mining.
Where does the... Is there a current flow through there? Like, where does it go?
It is the fastest current in the world. It flows down from Philippines, rushes through Indonesia, into Papua New Guinea, through to Fiji, Solomon Islands and Vanuatu.
Okay, right. That's quite a lot.
That is quite a lot. It's a massive area.
Yeah. And the things we've been talking about in New Zealand is the sediment plume being a major issue. I presume this is the same for what will be happening.
Absolutely.
And there's no research, is there? We were told there was research here, but it's theoretical.
No, there's no research.
There's no research.
We've written a few reports, particularly focused on Nautilus's environmental impact statement. And so one thing we've been pushing is there's a lack of adherence to the precautionary principle because there's no science. We only know maybe 5% or less of the marine life in those deep sea waters.
Right.
And when you're talking about sediment plumage, we don't know to how big they'll be. The ocean moves. We have currents. We have upwelling. And the cumulative impacts of opening more of one of those sites is a complete unknown. So this is an experiment.
Mm.
It is absolutely an experiment. And the communities in Papua New Guinea and across the Pacific have been saying this from the beginning. They've been experimented on over and over again. Yeah, and this is just another frontier industry trying to come in and experiment in a country that can barely regulate and monitor its mining on land, let alone deep down 1,500 metres in the ocean.
So are you watching this case in New Zealand closely?
Yes, we are. Because, if you've got it onshore, how well would you trust your oysters now, knowing that that's what they use?
Well, presumably one of the dangers for things like shellfish is that they just get clogged up with sediment. It's not something they're used to, not filtering that much anyway.
Mm. But how much would you trust it on the shelf now, knowing that that's down outside on the sea?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, you probably want to take your kids out, and then you want them to taste a bit of seafood. How well would you trust your fish? It now will make you start thinking about your health as to how much are you putting that into your body.
So for the people who are living along the coast of Papua New Guinea, presumably fishing is their food source, food source for them?
Yes, 99%.
If that food source became unavailable, which I'm sure is something you've been thinking
it's
about...
It's indirect genocide. You're killing us.
Okay.
Because there's one person who's working will feed about 30 to 40 people. And believe me, when you're on a wage structure that only gives you about 300 kina, which is about $150...
Per
fortnight.
Okay.
That's nothing. You basically can't buy anything.
So our
land and sea is very, very important to us.
Yeah, so there's no immediate alternative.
No, there isn't.
Knowing the history of the Papua New Guinea government, what are they likely to do if people do start starving along the coast?
Absolutely nothing. Because I can quote our Prime Minister. He went to the World Economic Forum in New York and stated that he's feeding the entire nation when we have a drought in our highlands region. And my village and several other villages within the Karakuhiri area of Central Province actually have been facing a flood for 3 weeks, and the government couldn't even give one toya for our people to help our people, because everywhere that we went, our National Disaster Office, going to the social offices that we have and authorities in terms of helping with our floods, they all came up with we don't have funding. So if the government cannot help with our floods and droughts, they won't be able to help 6 million people.
And so the Prime Minister can say that in international forums because no one there knows what's going on in Papua New Guinea.
Yes.
Does anyone in Papua New Guinea know what he's saying when he's out there? Oh, you do, but...
We've seen it on social media. What we do now is that anything that is said, we take it out and download it. We put it out on the good USB stick, thank God for technology, and we take that out into the villages and project it out for people to see and hear.
What sort of response do you get when people are watching that?
Very angry response.
Mm.
It's that ignorance, because, see, 11% of our country has access to internet and phones.
Yeah.
Which is a very small percentage. And the fact that the rest of them don't know anything is where the government takes advantage.
So they may not know that this is happening until the fish start to disappear or something like that.
Yeah. And they start realizing, oh, something's gone wrong. I'll give the Fly River example. Okteri. Okteri's right up in the mountains. It's about a good 2-hour flight away from their city of Daru. The people in Daru have the greatest barramundi that runs across through the Torres Strait, through the Western Fly and down into the Great Barrier Reef. That is disappearing.
Right.
Now, Okteri has tailings that run down the Fly River right in through to Daru and into Torres Strait. Nobody cares about our people. Not even Australia. I don't think they give a damn about Torres Strait Islanders. They're just proud to say that they're part of their people, but don't really do anything for them, because if they were concerned, they would check out how much of the tailings actually poison our sea. And the barramundi disappearing has made people now go and look for alternatives of which they're not used to.
So, yeah, the biggest thing with this that I'm getting out of it is just that no one knows what's going on.
Yes.
I mean, in New Zealand, we complain that only on the coast, on the west coast, do people know about the seabed mining issue, but we obviously have legal recourse and things like that, even if the last fight against TTR was, there seemed to be some bias creep into the process, we still have a court of appeal to go to. I mean, do you have access to the courts to fight this in Papua New Guinea?
We are taking the first legal step forward now in this case, to actually have the government and Nautilus give us access to information, because our biggest downfall is the access to information of what is happening, and we'd like to see what exactly have they agreed to.
So there's no EPA like we have here?
No, there isn't.
Was there any process to approve the deep sea mining?
Well, there are processes that are there, but the government skips a lot of them in their favour, reckoning that they are the best and are mandated to do it.
Mm. Now, the other thing I wanted to ask too, like in New Zealand, to oppose something like this, if you really get under the skin of the people, the powerful people, they just make you look bad in the media and destroy your credibility. What happens? What are the dangers of fighting this fight in Papua New Guinea?
Well, if we look at how many environmental activists around the world have been disappearing, I'm sure that'll give you a hint as to what has been happening with me.
So you haven't disappeared yet?
I haven't disappeared yet, and I don't intend to disappear yet.
But things are not safe for you?
No, they're not. But I'm not one to be afraid of such threats or people thinking that they can do something to me. It's my land, and I have every right to speak about it.
So what precautions do you have to take when you're at home?
When I'm at home, yes, I do have people who watch over me. Very, very closely. I'm careful as to where I do go. But I'm not afraid to stand out in public and take out the loud hailer and scream the shit out of people when I feel like it.
Well, that's probably very brave. This is, you know, for us in New Zealand, this is I don't know, it's more like a movie than a, you know, hearing things like that. Our only familiarity with that sort of thing is in movies and things like that. So it's hard to relate to in a real sense.
But it is happening all over the world. And even I would say that it's most probably happening here too. You have the sense of security because of policies, and your authorities do make you feel that you are in control or that they are in control. But there are things that do happen with that don't get told too.
Oh, I know. There's a lot of things that don't get into the mainstream media.
Yes.
This seabed mining is one thing. It's kind of a little bit gets in, but.
I'm sure here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, as in Australia, there's been particularly this sort of neoliberalism that's emerged through the 90s. Our civil liberties are continually getting eroded.
Yeah, well, we just had a law passed a year or two ago about not being allowed to protest at sea.
Yeah.
Someone immediately went out to actually protest at sea to prove that they were still going to do it.
And that's actually important. We actually have to challenge those new laws the best we can, as soon as we can, and set a precedent. It's actually very, very important. Because while our brothers and sisters around the world, particularly Latin America, the Philippines, and Papua New Guinea and in parts of Africa, they're actually dying at the front lines. They're getting killed or incarcerated. We have to keep fighting here. Because gradually it's going to keep getting eroded and eroded and eroded. And, you know, Australia has New Zealand, very proud long histories of fighting for our rights and for the right to protest. And we must continue to make sure we can do that.
Yeah. All right. So I know you guys have got to head off. You're going to Radio New Zealand, hopefully. They probably won't give you so much time, but they'll have more listeners than I have. Is there stuff that New Zealand can do, that people in New Zealand can do? I mean, I know the solidarity is important.
Yes.
But some people in New Zealand have more time on their hands. Is there things they can do to help out with the situation of Papua New Guinea?
I think, first of all, stand up with everyone here who's fighting seabed mining.
Yeah.
By standing up here and making that a prominent issue in the Pacific will only help Papua New Guineans and other Pacific Islanders who are fighting against this frontier industry of seabed mining, whether it's shallow seabed mining or deep seabed mining. We know the impacts are going to be there, and they're going to be devastating. So doing that, getting informed, there's a website, deepseaminingoutofourdepth.org. It's all one word. And that has a lot of information about the sort of campaign in the Pacific. And you can search for us on Facebook. And the Alliance of Soata Warriors, which is the Papua New Guinean sort of resistance against this, you can search that Soara, Solwara, Warriors on Facebook. And they've got a Facebook page with sort of updates of what they're doing.
Okay, well, look, I'd like to thank you guys heaps for coming in. I know you probably got told at the last minute that you might have an interview. I'm glad you did, because I couldn't make it last night.
That's good.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
So, folks, we've been talking. That was Natalie Lowry's voice you just heard. She's a Kiwi, grew up in Piha, involved in the fight in Papua New Guinea and based in Australia now. Was that right?
Yep.
Yes. And Lucille Paru, who's a chief and a leader in the fight against seabed mining in Papua New Guinea, where it sounds like things are quite different to New Zealand. but the root problem is still the same.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.